Hello, this is the Love Letter Squad. I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gallen, and we welcome you to another wonderful 30 minutes of a story and a love letter. And I want to go right to our guest, Musaddiq Bidar, who is, how old are you now?
I'm 17.
17, that's what I thought, and is fairly new to the United States and really has a story to share that is so filled with courage and hope and elegance of behavior that is just really will shine a light on a life beautifully lived. And let's just go right to you. I'd like you to tell us where you're from and what life was like until you got here.
Well, I was born in Afghanistan, originally from Afghanistan. I was born in the capital in Kabul. And, starting out, things were pretty good. My dad had a job. My mom had a job. You know, my mom worked at the airport. And my dad was a producer for a youth radio show in Kabul. So, you know, things were pretty good. And as the war started again, you know, as the Taliban took over, things started getting worse and worse. And, you know, my family was concerned for our safety.
Now, did they see something bad coming as it was coming? I mean, I know it happened rather quickly as political tragedies
go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when the Taliban first took over, a lot of people were happy because of that, because they cut the Mujahideen down. And, you know, people were going to say, were thinking that the Taliban were good for us.
I see.
But my dad worked for the government, and he was against the Taliban. And he would write, you know, in the newspapers and magazines against them. And they started coming after him. And
how did they do that?
You know, just by threats here and there, you know, sending people after him. And then what really hit us hard was and made my dad make the decision to leave Afghanistan was a bomb fell on our house, and it killed my grandfather on the spot. And it injured my father as well. And at that point, my dad said, you know, we can't do this anymore. We have to get out of here because it wasn't safe for us.
And how old were you?
At the time, I was about 3 or 4.
Do you remember this?
I don't remember much of it. I remember, you know, the time everybody being sad and, you know, just in a hurry and being worried. But when the bomb fell, I was in the basement because, you know, when the war started, my mom would take me and my brother down to the basement because it was a lot safer down there. And so this happened during the day. They just happened to be upstairs in the front yard and, you know.
So how long between this bomb and you're actually leaving?
About 6 months.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. So after the bomb hit, we moved up to where one of my mom's brothers lived. He had a whole, you know, he had a bunch of land with him, and it was a lot safer there because it was out of the city.
I see.
And so after staying there, you know, we couldn't live with somebody else for a long time. My dad said, you know, let's move to Pakistan because we thought the war was going to be temporary. You know, it was going to be over after a little while. So we're just going to come back. So we lock everything up at the house.
Oh.
Leave with the suitcase of clothes and, you know, some money.
Was Pakistan culturally similar enough that it was not a difficult move?
Yeah, it was pretty similar. You know, it's a Muslim nation and, you know, the people are pretty similar. And the only thing that's different is the language.
Mm-hmm.
So we take a bus ride across the border to Pakistan, and we are placed in a refugee camp.
Were you frightened on this bus ride, or did you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, you knew to be.
I was just a little kid, you know, surrounded by people, you know, filled with, you know, anger in their faces, and they've got all they have with them is a bag, a suitcase of clothes. And so I kind of had no idea what was going on or what, you know, where I was going to be the next day. So we get to the refugee camp. And they give each family a tent. With us, it was me, my dad, my mom, my younger brother, my aunt, and my grandma. So it was six of us in a tent, you know, about this half the size of this room.
So like about, what, 6 by 6?
6 by 6, right, yeah. And they gave us a bag of flour and a bag of rice. And the rest of it you have to figure out on your own. You know, you have to figure out where you were going to sleep, how you're going to keep warm.
How long were you there?
At this camp, we were there for 5-6 months. And then it wasn't safe there, nor was it, you know, the right place for us to be because we didn't have a way of making money. You can't live on a bag of rice, a 20-pound bag of rice and a 10-pound bag of flour for monthly, you know. And my dad said, we have to move to the city.
So how did he manage to get out of the refugee camp with you?
Well, you just take a bus down to the city.
Oh, so you just have to pave your own way and find a job someplace new.
We got lucky because we knew some people in Pakistan who had moved out earlier. You know, my dad knew some people, and he had a friend who lived in Islamabad, that's the capital of Pakistan, which was about a three-hour bus drive from where we were at the refugee camp. And so we moved down to the city, and we met up with him, and he had a carpet-making factory.
And that's where you sat
and that's where things got started.
And wait, so how old were you when you started working at a carpet-making factory?
I think I was around five or six,
I read that.
Yeah, five or six.
How did you learn, what kind of skill can be taught to a little six-year-old?
You know, at first, it, for me, just started out as doing some of the little basic stuff.
Like what?
Like, well, we had these tools that had, like, a hook on top.
So you learned how to knot?
How to knot with that.
And
the tool has a hook on top, and it's got a sharp blade and a handle.
Yeah, sure.
And you make knots with the hook, and then you just cut
it. So, but my question is, I guess my amazement is that at six you were learning to weave effectively.
Yeah.
And to hook rugs.
Basically.
Aren't you shocked when you look back?
But you know, that's all I had to do all day long. Yeah. So
and that was like 12-hour days?
Yeah, 12-hour day. Wake up at 6 in the morning, eat breakfast, start, work till 12. You get a 30-minute lunch.
Were the people who ran this carpet-making factory decent to you in any way?
Yeah, yeah. We were friends, and they really helped us out a lot because they had a factory, and then they had this this house with four rooms, and they rented us one of the rooms. And they had there were two other families in the other rooms, and then they had one room which was a little bigger where the carpet.
So this was already better than the refugee camp.
Oh, much, much better.
And it wasn't like you felt you were in prison or in some kind of a torture land.
Sort of, but it was better than
the
camp because here it was safe, and we were making money. If you went outside and the police saw that you were Afghan and you were a refugee, they would bother you a lot because they asked for papers like, you know, a passport and the visas, which a lot of people didn't have because they just crossed.
How can they see that you're Afghan?
They just look at you. They can tell.
Really?
And they have the right to just stop you. Like, I remember.
I understand that, but I'm just wondering how you can assume that somebody is from someplace else without talking to them. Or
exactly, yeah.
Maybe they ask everybody. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember there was a time where my dad and I, we were coming back from the supermarket, you know, from the farmer's market with groceries and stuff, and we're on the bus, and the police stops the bus. And he just looks at me and my dad. He goes, "You two, come out."
My goodness.
And we sit on the sidewalk for about 20 minutes, and he didn't need anything. He just wanted our money. My dad had about 1,000 rupees on him, which is the equivalent of like $20.
He took it?
No.
Oh.
Which we got lucky. As soon as we sat on the curb, my dad passed this money to me, and I put it in my sock.
Oh, good for you.
And he didn't search me because I was young. He just searched my dad, and he knew my dad had money, but my dad just never gave in. And he's like, "No, I'm not giving you any money." And there was a lady sitting on the bus. She just started yelling at this police officer. She's like, "You know what? This isn't fair. This isn't justice."
Good.
Yeah, she's like, "You know, these guys are Muslim. We're Muslim. Why are you being like this?" And
good question.
He just told the driver to drive away.
So I'm hearing something in this that your dad was a brave, smart man.
Oh, yeah.
So you get some of this genetically.
I think
right?
so, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's lucky. Okay, so then where did you go after this? How old were you when you stopped making rugs and you moved on?
Okay, so the story goes on. We keep making carpets. You had a month to build a carpet, and then the people who were in charge would go out and sell this carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And however much it sold for, you got part of that money.
Oh.
So if you were slow and you didn't build your carpet within a month,
yeah.
you didn't get the money.
Right.
And, you know, there were times where we didn't make it through the month where we were down to, you know, the last couple dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it got rough. But we had people there who really helped us out. Like I said, my dad's friend, if we were short on money, he would, you know, lend us some money. He'd be like, "Here, go get some groceries." You know,
how lucky and wonderful.
Exactly, yeah.
So how old were you when you left there?
When we left Pakistan, I was about 10. I was turning 11.
Oh, really? So 5 years?
Yeah,
five,
6 years.
And you hadn't been to school. You'd been making carpets every day.
Because we spent all day long making carpets,
there
was no time to go to school. And also, it cost money to go to school.
So you couldn't read or anything? Or did you get taught at home?
I could, kind of, because at night my parents would homeschool me.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So after dinner, we'd sit down here, do a little bit of math, 2 plus 2, and a little bit of reading. So, you know, I wasn't, you know, completely literate. I knew some stuff.
Good. Okay, so then what was next on your journey? Where did you go?
As soon as we started our lives in Pakistan with the carpets, my dad applied to the Australian embassy. We wanted to go to Australia. But they denied our petition for a visa, and they referred us to the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And we applied to the UN, and they referred us to the American embassy. And that's how it got started. It took 4 years, the whole process, interview after interview, and then they had, like, physicals and then seminars and stuff. And then it was...
Seminars on what?
You know, just after everything got accepted, they gave you seminars to see what life is like in America.
Oh,
so
nice.
So my parents would go to that. They, you know, they'd be talking to these people and mm-hmm. just to give them, you know, a sense of it.
I understand.
And then it was May 2nd, 2003, where we were just sitting down. It was around lunchtime where we got a call. It was from my dad, and they said that our petition for a visa had been accepted. And that was truly one of the happiest days of my life.
Oh.
We were just sitting there, you know, it was lunch break, and my dad comes in, he's like, we don't have to go back to work, you know?
So you get to take right off, pretty much.
Basically, it was May 2nd, they said our flight was on the 8th of May. So okay. we had 6 days to, you know, prepare everything all
So you went to where? Flight took you where?
We had five flights. From Islamabad to Karachi, another state in Pakistan, and then from Karachi, a stop in Dubai, and then from Dubai to Switzerland, from Switzerland, a 12-hour layover mm-hmm. in Switzerland, mm-hmm. and then from there to New York, from New York to Texas, mm-hmm. and then from Texas to Arizona, where we stayed for 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And then my mom had some friends who she worked with at the airport in Afghanistan who had left earlier. They stayed in Switzerland. And they had a brother in California.
Oh.
And so my mom got in touch with them, and they said, look, my brother's in California. Contact him. He can help you guys out. California is pretty close to Arizona.
Right.
So my mom called him up, and he just happened to have a daughter who lived in Arizona, about 30 minutes away from us. And so she came down, you know, helped us out a little. And after a 3-month stay in Arizona, he said that it would be better for us to move to California.
So here you are.
Because we knew him, and there would be a lot more opportunities out there.
So what happened then? I mean, your English was coming along?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as I started school, I was 6 years behind everybody
else. Yes,
and what I did to catch up on English was just watch TV, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
You know, once you keep hearing English... And it stays in your
Teresa
head.
And I were just talking about that earlier, about how valuable television and computers are in teaching quickly.
Yeah, cartoons especially,
yes.
you know? And when you're a young kid, you start to learn really quickly.
Yes,
and
okay.
And I picked up on English quickly, and, you know, I was able to socialize at school. I was able to, you know, get my homework done.
So tell us about school now. You go to which...
Well, right now I go to Athenian.
Right. Now, and you got into there from what grade?
Starting in ninth grade.
Tell us a little bit of Athenian. That's a private school,
Athenian
right?
Athenian is a very prestigious private school in Danville. How I got in was when I was in middle school, I had a friend named DJ Lynch mm-hmm. who would come over to my house, and he would tutor my brother and I in like math and
mm-hmm.
English. And he went to Athenian.
Oh.
And when I got to eighth grade, his mom said that I should apply to Athenian.
For a scholarship.
For a full ride scholarship.
How nice.
And, you know, it wasn't going to hurt me if I did, you know, because I had nothing to lose.
Right.
And I applied, and I got in. And here I am now. I went to Athenian. It was a big difference because all the students there had gone to private schools their entire lives. They got a top-notch education.
Yeah. So did you feel comfortable? I mean, this is clearly a different upbringing and a different...
Not at first. At first, you know, I was kind of out of place because mm-hmm. I went to this middle school where I didn't have to work hard and I still got good grades. And then I was thrown into this situation.
Were you welcomed by the other students?
Oh, I was definitely welcomed.
How
but,
nice.
You know, the level of it of education was a lot higher, and I didn't have... the tools from my past to catch up to
that. I understand that
so
part.
It took a lot of time and a lot of more work.
So here's where we put in a word for hard work
mm-hmm.
and sticking to the task ahead
yeah.
of you
yeah.
and knowing that there is a life ahead of you that's filled with opportunity.
Definitely, yeah. They, you know, when I applied to Athenian, they told me it wasn't going to be easy, and they told me it was going to be a lot of hard work. and that I had to really commit to it if I wanted to be successful.
On the other hand, and a six-year-old who can learn to hook rugs can do probably any hard work.
Exactly. I was, you know, I took on that challenge, and I said, why not? You know, if this is going to help me in 5, 6, 7 years,
right,
you know, in the future, you know, I'm just going to grind out through these couple of years, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
And did you have a social life while you were working this hard?
Not my first year, no, because, you know, I would get home. I played sports also.
Oh, okay.
So during basketball season.
That's kind of a social life.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, you had friends and people you did things with.
And I also had friends from middle school who I'd hang out with, you know, because all my friends that went to Athenian lived either in Oakland or Danville, mm-hmm. and it was like a 30-minute drive, and, mm-hmm. you know, that wasn't easy for me.
Right.
So I just stick to my middle school friends. You know, we got along. And then as my sophomore year came along, things started to get a little better, and I was catching up on work. You know, my English was getting better, and, you know, so was my math and science.
So I have a question. Did you, at any time in your young life, seeing your parents fleeing and being part of that, and mm-hmm. having nothing that was home after you had had something that was a beautiful home before the Taliban,
mm-hmm.
did you ever feel hopeless? Or were you too young to know,
you know, I think in Pakistan I was too young to know because mm-hmm. I wasn't going to school. And as a kid, not going to school, not having to do homework, you're kind of happy. It's like a vacation for you.
And you're with your parents
and
all the time.
And with your parents all day, and you're sitting inside having fun, you know.
What did you think your life would be?
I thought I'd just be sitting in that factory all my life, not having anything else to do. You know, but now that I'm in this position and I look back at it, I am like, wow, I could not see myself over there right now, you know. This is a much better life, you know. I can do something.
And this is your life and you're in charge.
Yeah, exactly. Over there, you know, somebody else was standing on top of me telling me what to do.
Okay. This is just so good to hear this. This is so good to hear this because you obviously are a different person, and you look ahead of you, and I would guess there's no hopelessness.
Oh, no. Now that I'm in this position, and I see that I'm going to college, and, you know, next year I will be in college, and, you know, I have so much to look forward to.
Do you have any feel for what you want to do in life? It's a silly question to ask somebody this young, because why should you have to know? But
yes, kind of. Yeah, I want to be a journalist and broadcasting. I want to go into that. It's definitely one of my goals to go back to Afghanistan, you know, kind of look at what's going on over there and then bring that back to America through my own eyes.
Good for you.
Because a lot of people here don't actually know what's going on back there.
Oh, for sure.
They see the news and stuff.
Honest journalism is a wonderful thing when you can get it.
Yeah, so they put stereotypes on it. And so, you know, they don't really know the culture and the history.
Right.
And I want to bring that here so it can kind of bridge that whole gap between, you know, the Western world and Afghanistan.
So people need to see the beauty of the culture and the importance of it rather than the war.
Rather than just think Afghanistan and see war.
Misery
and
war.
People dying.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So let me ask you something. And because we're about writing letters and expressing gratitude and love, mm-hmm. who would get a love letter from you today? I can see so many people, like parents and classmates.
There are
a lot
of people.
Let's pick a couple.
My parents definitely.
You're going to go home from here with a little homework.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you're so used to homework now, this shouldn't bother you, right?
Oh, no, not
okay.
at all.
So, have you ever written a letter to your parents?
Sort of. I was away on a 26-day backpacking trip last year for my junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got through our first week and they said, you know, you can write letters to home now. And, you know, I wrote a little something about how things were going and, you know.
Okay, good point. I'm so mm-hmm. glad you said that because a letter about how things are going,
mm-hmm.
even though it's written in a spirit of love and it's a loving letter because they, after all, are your parents who essentially gave you life and then saved your life
mm-hmm.
and brought you to a place where you could have a beautiful life.
Yeah.
Different than a love letter.
Okay.
So your life is so important, it seems to me, in the way of what you've accomplished in 17 years and the several different lives you've lived in 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that it's your parents' strength that got you to this place.
Oh,
and your own strength and talent, of course, also.
Mm-hmm.
So a love letter is a tribute to them.
Okay.
And anything you write down is going to be not only part of your personal history, your family history, the history of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. a little bit the history of Pakistan, and American history. Mm-hmm. So a letter that you, and I'm saying this to a man who's going to be a journalist, so you can understand all this.
Yeah.
But a letter that says to someone else, here's what I know about you, here's what I'm grateful for, and here's what I love, mm-hmm. and will know till the day I die, is a different thing than an accounting.
Yeah.
And how valuable for them to have that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
What do you think?
I like the idea.
I mean, I've seen reactions, you know, when parents get letters from adult children.
Mm-hmm.
And the reaction is almost always, I didn't know you knew that about me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know you remembered that. I didn't know you were aware of that. It's such a gift.
Hmm.
So you want to write to your parents separately or together?
Together, I think.
Okay, so what do you call them?
Mom and Dad.
Okay. And when you speak to each other, I'm just curious, at home, what language do you live
Farsi.
In? Oh, you do? Farsi, okay. Yeah. Just because it's smoother to think.
And it's easier for them, too.
Yes. Yeah. Do they speak English well?
They speak a little bit of English, but not that well. You know, they're getting better at it, but it's a lot easier for them to communicate in Farsi.
Then you write this in Farsi, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm in English.
Okay. And, excuse me, if they need help, you'll translate it for them when they get it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you want to tell them?
First of all, I want to thank them,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because they've done so much for me from, you know, like you said, from day one, they gave me birth and then they saved my life again. You know, now that I'm thinking back at it, being in Pakistan, they were the ones who kind of started everything for us, you know.
In what way?
You know, well, my dad, he had polio when he was 4, so he can't really work. He's disabled from his right hand and left leg.
Mm-hmm.
And to see him being in that position, not having a lot of physical ability, but still being so strong. And, you know, he would wake up with us, even though he didn't have to work. He would wake up with us at 6 in the morning, and he would help us. He would tell us where to not what and to do what, and he would help us you know, color up the grass for the carpets, and he would cook us breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then coming here, my mom, who's done so much, I remember when we first got to California, she would take Bart from Concord all the way to San Francisco, work at a Subway store, go all the way back, you know, pick us up from school, and then go to adult school to learn English.
Wow.
And she did this, you know, for 2-3 years, where she would wake up early at 6 in the morning because I didn't have a ride to school. She would walk me 2-3 blocks to a neighbor's house. They would drive me to school. Then she would come back, walk my brother and sister to school. Then she would walk back home, walk to work. And then after work, where she got off at 9 p.m., she would go to adult school again until like 10:30. So there would be days where I wouldn't even see her.
Okay, so you just done something wonderful that we talk about in love letters, which is the specifics.
Mm-hmm.
And for a mother to know that she did everything right and that you as a young boy
mm-hmm.
were aware of how hard she worked will be such a gift to her.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm taking notes for you, and I like to do that with our guests because mm-hmm. I don't like people to forget some of the wonderful things they've said.
Yeah.
But as you're saying this, I can see I don't have to take any.
Mm-hmm.
Because it'll all come again when you start.
Yeah, once I think about it, it all just hit me.
So as long as this letter needs to be,
mm-hmm.
and people don't throw away love letters.
No.
And someday your grandchildren will find this. Mm-hmm. And they will be so American by then that it will be a really important reminder, I think. Don't you think, Teresa?
Oh, absolutely.
Of what their origin was
mm-hmm.
and how hard it was, well, to get here and get started. And it wasn't an easy thing, but they come from people who were strong and smart
mm-hmm.
and stuck to the road ahead of them. That's a wonderful pedigree to have for your grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about, and this will be in your handwriting?
Yeah.
That's important.
Yes.
Okay. And the other thing is, you know, we've got letters from John Hancock and Abe Lincoln and notes, and letters really tend to last longer than a DVD or a CD or photographs, because mm-hmm. first of all, technology changes.
Yeah.
And so what you send by some electronic means, you may not be able to access in 25 years, let alone 3 generations.
Mm-hmm.
If you use good, strong stationery and indelible ink.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll last forever.
So what kind of stationery would you use? I like to ask that.
let's see, a pen, just because a pencil, you know, it starts to...
Well, definitely a pen, yeah, that's right. But what kind of paper?
Just regular paper.
Okay. Yeah.
Binder paper.
Binder paper is really nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, and I don't know, you did something that is just so dear to me, because it's good to choose stationery that reflects either you mm-hmm. or the person you're writing to.
Okay.
And it's so natural, you're a student.
Yeah.
You just
yeah.
finished high school. Binder paper is your paper.
Exactly.
It's your daily paper. So how nice for them to have a note on what is mm-hmm. your natural way of writing.
Yeah.
You know, not to be something that you have to feel obligated to do something different. That's really nice. And you will put the date on it, right?
Definitely. Yes.
Okay, because that's really...
I remember this time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, it's nice. It'll be nice for them when they're older.
Mm-hmm.
And you also, by the way, make a copy for yourself.
Okay, I will.
Because yeah. when you're an old man...
Mm-hmm. I could look back and
yes.
read it. And,
yes,
you know.
And see exactly the date that you felt all this. So what's your goal in writing this letter?
To let my parents know how much I appreciate mm-hmm. what they've done for me. You know,
that's kind of a nice way to start a letter, by setting out what it is you want.
Yeah, okay. yeah. You know, they've done so much, and sometimes, you know, they may think that we don't realize that, but we actually do, you know.
And you
want
to say not, that. And
we may not show it through our daily actions, but it is there.
So you want to say that yeah. exactly, specifically,
yes,
so
I
they'll
do.
Know.
Yeah.
Okay. And you live at home?
I do.
Okay,
yes.
So here's a question about love letters.
Mm-hmm.
Will you give it to them, or will you mail it to them?
I'm not sure. I have to think about that.
Okay.
You know, I want to see. I'm not sure if I want to give it to them straight up, or I want to surprise them with it, you know? So
there
when
you
I'm
go.
Away in college, they can get it or something. I don't
or
know.
Even get it while you're just out playing football for the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think there's something about getting a letter in the mail,
mm-hmm.
because how often do you get something gorgeous in the mail anymore?
Yeah, yeah, you know.
That's a real gift, I think.
Mm-hmm. When you open up that letter and you see it, you get really excited, you know?
Exactly. Do you get letters from friends ever? I mean...
Not nowadays. You know, everything is just
right.
email
right.
and online and Facebook and things
right.
like that. That, you know, letters is kind of going away. So, you know, it's kind of...
So let's bring them back.
Yeah, why not?
Yes. Because that other stuff will all go away eventually. You
yeah,
know, it all does. I mean,
true.
We don't use the sundial anymore. We don't use a rotary phone.
Mm-hmm.
We don't use rabbit ear television antennas. Have
yeah.
you ever heard of these things?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I just didn't know. Okay, well, so this is so nice, and I just wish you the best in life, and I know we're going to hear from you in life.
Oh, definitely.
And so to all our listeners, Musaddiq Bidar, just remember the name, and thank you very much for doing with us
thank you.
This
thank
show.
You for having me.
Thank you for the good news. There's so much bad news in the world today.
Yeah, yeah.
You are good news.
It's a joy
mm-hmm.
to
you
have a
have
good
to
news story.
Look at the positives, you know?
Yes.
Right. And I think in just a second left, it speaks to the generosity of human beings,
mm-hmm.
the kinds of things you experienced, all of the help that you were given along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it also speaks to the kind of generosity you expressed mm-hmm. that it comes back to you.
Yeah. Just shows that there are still good people out there.
Absolutely. And
millions.
We try to find them.
Yes.
Well, thank you all for joining us. We hope you'll be with us every week at this time. And we encourage you always to put your loving sentiments into words and send them while you still have the chance.
Yes, and if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, please remember that writing that love letter is your special occasion.
All right. So, for now, this
Bye.
Is Teresa
and Janet.
Bye-bye.